Toronto, Canada. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Historian, philosopher, writer, mystic, 32nd degree Freemason, Robert W. Sullivan IV is here to reveal esoteric and occult symbols in cinema. And he's here for the full 2 hours. This is going to be good. Carlos Cagina is my technical producer, and Ryan White is the live stream producer. And yes, we are live streaming on my YouTube channel, Strange Planet. And if for any reason Big Tech Gestapo takes any of my YouTube videos down, you can always head over to rumble.com. And Ryan uploads every episode there, rumble.com, usually within a few days. And then when you get to rumble.com, search under channels for Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Before we get rolling, if you've just subscribed recently to my newsletter, Inner Sanctum, in the last few days, you've probably missed the final edition of Inner Sanctum until September. Inner Sanctum, my free monthly newsletter, is going into summer hiatus just for a couple of months, but you can continue to subscribe, and then you'll be all set when I start publishing again in September. Go to strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca, and click on the Inner Sanctum banner to subscribe. I just need an email. It takes about 5 seconds. And again, delivered right to your email inbox for free, but on summer hiatus until September. Well, everyone's favorite Freemason is here, and he strikes again with Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Unveiled. Applying his expert and objective observations, Robert W. Sullivan IV analyzes a new slate of movies, revealing Tinseltown's esoteric and dark secrets. Some of the films dissected in this new volume are The Mummy from 1932, The Witch, 2015, Lolita, 1962, Joker, 2019, Dark City, The Red Shoes, Midsommar, Eraserhead, Pan's Labyrinth, Chris Nolan's Dark Knight Trilogy, The Shape of Water, and The Vast Mythology of Twin Peaks, among countless others. From Gnosticism to Freemasonry to Black Magic and Kabbalah, no rock is ever left unturned with Robert's books. Robert is a historian, philosopher, antiquarian, jurist, lay theologian, writer, mystic, and lawyer. The author of 5 books. His latest, as I say, is Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Unveiled. Hey, Robert, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, Richard. Thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to tonight's show.
Likewise. Now, just kind of on a personal note, you're Robert Sullivan IV. Can you tell me a little bit about your ancestors?
Sure. Robert W. Sullivan I, I never knew. And Robert W. Sullivan II died when I was very young. My grandfather, he was a Freemason, but I did not know him that long. He died when I was about 9 years old, maybe 10. My father is still around. He is doing well. And then, of course, me.
But were they all Masons?
No. My great-grandfather and grandfather were. Robert W. Sullivan I and II were Freemasons. The third, my father, is not. It skipped over him. I am. And then some of the ancestors on my mother's side were Masons as well. So senior and junior were Masons. In fact, I believe senior may have been a past master. I mean, he ran the lodge.
How many times do you watch a movie before you've sort of totally unpacked it in terms of the esoteric and occult symbology until you've basically found it all?
Yeah, it's a great question. The truth of the matter is it's probably never ending. I've watched, I'm mentioning this to you, there are some movies even to this day that I still put on, and it's always with a little trepidation that I'm going to see something new, and it's always the case. You think you've pinned down everything, and then sure enough, something new comes up that you missed or, you didn't quite pick up on. something like that. Like, for example, I mean, I'll give you an example of this. One of the movies that I dissected in the new book was the Halloween 2018 movie. And the trailer for the new one, Halloween Kills, just dropped the other day. And because I really was impressed with the trailer and I really look forward to seeing it. I'm a huge fan of the Halloween movies. And because of that, I went back and I watched the first one. I have the 2018 movie here on Blu-ray. I have some of the other Halloweens as well, but I watched the 18 movie. And this was, again, a movie that I broke down in the latest book. There's a loads of, like, deja vu, overlap. You get the feeling that the filmmakers were familiar with the Mandela effect and were trying to incorporate a lot of the past movies into this new one with overlapping scenes, such as so on and so forth. And when I was watching it, there's a scene at the very beginning of it where Michael is in the asylum and these two reporters come in to talk to him. And this this one inmate screams out Figaro twice. He's Figaro. A mental patient. Yeah, and he screams out twice. And I was always perplexed by that. And even when I was doing the book, I couldn't quite figure that out. I thought maybe it has something to do with music. Of course, everyone knows the Barber of Seville, the Mozart opera.
Right.
And I couldn't quite pin this down. And the other day when I was watching it, I just started Googling and I tried to figure out, you know, what I mean, this must have some sort of meaning. And sure enough, it's a slang word. It's very, very rarely used, but it is a slang word meaning interloper or an interferer. And what it is referring to is the guy, the reporter holding up the mask of Michael Myers. He's sort of, interfering and he's, you know, provoking this guy to go on this kill crazy rampage again. So that's what it means. It's basically a reference to the reporter holding up the mask that he's agitating Michael again to go out, break out and kill. So again, I always usually have to watch them at least four or five times. I have to watch them on Blu-ray to be able to really pin them down, because you need to pause it, fast forward, go back forward to pick up on things. Usually four or five, maybe six times usually does it. Three, two, depending on how complex or detailed the movie is or how sophisticated the filmmaker is. Sometimes maybe just once or twice. Again, it just depends on the sophistication of the filmmaker. But there is that slate of movies, that those one or two movies out there that seems like every time I watch it, I pick up on something new.
And why do directors or screenwriters or producers insert these, I call them Easter eggs, little things that you that you uncover? Why do they put them in there in the first place?
Yeah, I use the term Easter egg also in the book. The motivations are many. I guess ultimately what it boils down to, in my opinion, is it's a form of enhancing the movie, and it really casts the movie into the mythological atmosphere. It goes for more than just being celluloid and pictures on celluloid, where it becomes this transcendent piece of artwork, really, informing and shaping pop culture. That's what these, Easter eggs, these symbols, these themes, these undercurrents. Because it's a whole slate. It's a whole, symphony of things that these filmmakers use. It's not just symbols. It's people. It's colors. It's music. It's themes, undercurrents. These things, when you get these into the hands of a very knowledgeable filmmaker, or producer, or writer, it really, in my opinion, enhances the movie. And I've always felt that when you come across these movies, not all of them have it, of course, but when you have an adroit filmmaker or producer or filmmaking crew, it really can transform the film into a piece of artwork and just really make it transcendent. That's what I think.
But most people, Robert, most people are not as well read as you are. I certainly am not. And so in order for that, those layers, the symbols, the symbology, the colors, the themes, the music, the receiver, the viewer has to understand, or does it affect us? I mean, much of this would probably just wash right over me and I wouldn't notice some of these esoteric symbols. Or does it matter? Does it work on a subconscious level? Does it awaken, certain archetypes that I might not even be aware of?
Absolutely. It definitely works. It works on both levels. It works on a subconscious level because, as you said, most people aren't aware of it. It becomes very interesting when you do become aware of it, and then you could start looking for it and seeing it for yourself. That was one of the motivations writing these books. But no, it definitely plays on the subconscious level when you're dealing with things like the archetypes. You read the Hermetic philosophers. This is part of, the archetypes are part of the world's soul, connecting you with the divine. The meditation on them brings you closer to the Godhead. And, it can be used to enlighten. Some people say it can be used to manipulate. I've never really found it to be that way. But, many people believe that the meditation on the archetypes brings you closer to the Godhead. You find this in the works of people like Carl Jung, Emanuel Swedenborg. I was on a show. It's one of the shows you host. It was Coast to Coast AM. And I was on with George Norrie. This was one of the first times I was on. And during the question and answer session, I had a screenwriter call in to the show. And he said, when I write scripts or when I'm doing this, he said, I concentrate on the archetypes, the son, the hero, the father, the villain, the shadow, the mother, the child, the lovers, this, the tarot. This is something that I'm constantly working with to, embed into the subconscious mind and to draw out from the subconscious mind. So, these filmmakers and writers use it too. I mean, you'll find these characters, these archetypes pervading the works of William Shakespeare. You'll find it in the works of Nathaniel Hawthorne, the 19th century American writers, Poe, Herman Melville. So, when you're crafting this stuff, that's something I use when I write books. It's something that artists are aware of, and they use it in their art to encapsulate, not encapsulate, to help put forth their artwork and to make it receivable to the person viewing it or reading it or watching it.
Now, to some, Robert, Hollywood has this dark underbelly, and people believe that within Hollywood there's all sorts of horrible, unspeakable things happening, and there is mind control, and there is, what I'm referring to.
Right, sure, of course.
Do you think that some directors, writers, producers are trying to use occultic symbols, esoteric symbols, for dark purposes? And I don't know how that would work. People talk about, celebrities flashing Illuminati symbols and so forth.
Sure.
Are they using films in this way? Is that possible?
It's of course possible. It's certainly definitely possible. I mean, there is always, when you're dealing with this stuff, there's always a light and a dark side to it. A Manichaean take on it, light and dark. They're interdependent, of course. Certain people, you could always craft an argument that this is being used for some sort of darker purpose. Of all the movies I've watched, and there's many of them, at no time did I ever feel like I was being mind controlled. I think some of this material is being used for sensationalist purposes, shock value, as it were. I think that's certainly an explanation for some of it. Certainly, in my opinion, where you get into the darker undercurrents of this stuff is where, we've talked about this before, is where these movies seem to be prophetic. They seem to be prophesizing different events.
Right. Predictive programming.
Predictive programming. I mean, how is this happening? That's kind of the million-dollar question, because I do find it hard to believe that Hollywood directors are using crystal balls to gaze into the future and then putting things into their movies. That, to me, strikes me as far-fetched and doesn't really kind of add up as a lawyer. I don't see any real reason for that. But nevertheless, I mean, we clearly have this happening. You can document it, all over the place. I mean, whether
right,
it's
we
the,
will get we'll get into that. We
sure,
will get
okay.
into that. We'll talk about predictive programming, and you do have an interesting theory as to what's actually happening there.
Sure. Even in Hollywood, I mean, you do have. Let's be honest. I mean, Hollywood does make some very dark movies, also. Not all of them, of course. I mean, they've made plenty of enlightening movies and uplifting movies, but they do make dark theme movies as well. So yeah, I mean, there is always, I mean, it's like everything else in this world. It's always multifaceted. It's complex. Nothing is ever 100% good or evil. It's always shades of gray, some darker than the others. This is the way, at least in my experience, the world works.
Well, yeah, and we will come back to predictive programming, but I was just going to say that, you know, one of the theories is that somehow at a certain level in Hollywood, because they control the culture, they have some sort of a pipeline into, I don't know, the national security state or the highest levels of the deep state, if you will, and they are given information before some cataclysmic event beforehand in order to do what? Maybe normalize it in people's minds or to prepare them or in some twisted way, like an artist, but he can't sign his name to this heinous act. And so he, or maybe there's some unwritten code that they have to let people know what they're doing. You've heard all of these theories.
Sure. I mean, Hollywood has worked with the government before. This is nothing new. I mean, I don't know if they'd be received. For starters, I mean, it presumes a lot. It presumes also that the government is orchestrating these events. And of course, that's speculation. But certainly, I know for a fact that the X-Files, when that aired, many of the scripts were reviewed by the FBI for accuracy. You get into the war, World War II. I mean, you have movies, Yankee Doodle Dandy was war propaganda. The early Sherlock Holmes, Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce movies put out by Universal, the first couple were war propaganda, for the Allied nations. This is, I mean, no question, intentional. The government's involvement with Hollywood, is documented. I mean, my God, Walt Disney was a spy for J. Edgar Hoover. It's not unheard of for Hollywood to be working with the government. The idea, though, that the government is crafting these events and then sending them to Hollywood, I don't know. I'd have to see a little more evidence of that. Like I said, it presumes that the government is, in fact, doing that. It's certainly something is going on. That's irrefutable because there's been too many instances in cinema where something is shown and then it happens in reality. So, like I said, clearly there is something to this. What it is, I don't think anyone can certainly pin down 100%. I have an explanation. I put forth sort of more of a rational explanation for it. But it is creepy, and it is uncanny, to say the least.
And it's something that we could go on and talk about all night. And, we won't talk about it all night, but we will dedicate some time for it. Robert W. Sullivan IV, Cinema Symbolism 3. And we'll take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll give some examples. We'll talk about the different types of occult symbolism, whether we're talking about Gnosticism and or Hermeticism, Kabbalah, even Christian symbology will work its way into Hollywood cinema. Back with more of our conversation. We'll also open up the phone lines in the second hour. So keep your powder dry until the second hour. Just sit back, enjoy the conversation, and then we'll make the phone lines available to you for questions and comments a little bit later. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show right after this. Stay with us.
The truth is not out there. It's right here. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett.
Welcome back. Robert W. Sullivan IV, historian, philosopher, antiquarian, jurist, lay theologian, writer, mystic, the author of 5 books, including his latest, Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Unveiled. So just so people understand what we're on about here, when we talk about different types of occult symbolism, let's start with one example, Gnosticism. Just explain what Gnosticism is in a very briefly, and then let's start with Gnosticism. Explain what Gnosticism is, and then give us some examples of a film where we'd find Gnostic symbology.
Sure. Gnosticism is a Christian heresy that goes back to about the second century, and it overlaps with Christianity, but it has a different take on it. It has to do with, it's a theology, a doctrine that has to do with awakening one's sort of inner self, coming to consciousness, to know thyself, as it were, which is also the maxim of Hermeticism, is to know thyself. It has three fountainheads of thought, three philosophers or theologians, I guess. Some would call them heretics, that expound Gnostic philosophy. And there are Manny, Valentinus, and Basilides. Those are the three fountainheads of Gnosticism. Manny is the easiest one. He is light and dark. It's sort of Zoroastrianism. The universe is composed of light and dark entities, agencies going against each other. This is good versus evil. This is light and dark. This is ignorance and knowledge. This is, in cinema, this would be the least interesting movie because it's the easiest to spot. So this would be Star Wars with Jedi versus Sith, or Harry Potter with Harry Potter versus the Death Eaters. The next one is I'll skip over Valentinus because I'll go to him last because he's the most interesting. The next one is Basilides. And I guess you probably have to talk about Valentinus first. He basically says that the way to get to the Godhead, that the way to get to the spiritual Godhead is through ignorance, is through willed oblivion, essentially. And I guess at this point I should explain what some of the Gnostic doctrines are. Essentially, it holds that there is this spiritual hidden God out there, what is known as the monad, and it has emanations. And one of them is this divine feminine, Aeon is what they're called Sophia. And she tries to study and understand the monad, which is a no-no. You can't do that. Essentially, she is cast out of this place called the Pleroma, which would equate to Christianity's heaven. And she's cast down into matter, into what's known as the Kenoma. And as she is being cast down, she births this deity known as the Demiurge, which is a Greek word meaning utility man. And this god fashions our universe. It's an error. It's created in mistake. And our reality is the product of this lesser god known as the Demiurge. And he rules the universe. But of course, as anyone familiar with this will tell you, he does not rule it alone. He has this coterie of angels and demons known as archons, who help him rule the universe, but they of course rule it imperfectly. And one of the purposes of the archons is to keep humankind asleep, is to keep them unconscious, is to keep them in stasis, keep them ignorant. And what these three Gnostic philosophers were trying to do was to come up with a cosmology and a system where humankind could awaken out of the slumber and obtain the spiritual divinity and return back to this monad, this godhead. And what Basilides said was the way to do this is through willed ignorance, is to be completely stupid and to live in oblivion. It's a form of Zen Buddhism, essentially, you meditate, you sit in a corner, you don't do anything. Opening your eyes, you're participating in the Demiurge's reality. Speaking, you're participating in the Demiurge's reality. You to essentially do nothing. The movie that reflects this is the movie by David Cronenberg called Existenz, where the characters by the end of the movie, this is Jude Law and Jennifer Jason Leigh, are just so completely stupid and out of it, they don't know what reality they're even living in anymore. The main one, and this is the movie that everyone likes, is the Valentinius thread. And he is the guy who is putting forth what I just said, that there is this demiurgic creator of the universe that is inherently flawed, and that humankind needs to escape it, and you have to escape the archons. And what he runs contradictory to Basilides. He said the way that humankind can awaken their consciousness and return back to the monad is through wisdom. The more the more knowledge the human being requires, the more consciousness he has. This is frowned upon by the Demiurge and the Archons because they want to keep humankind asleep. And this allows the soul to transcend after death and return to the monad. And of course, this is reflected in Christianity. This is reflected in Gnosticism and Hermeticism and in Kabbalah. This is what are called like these celestial spheres. In Kabbalah, they're known as the Sephirot. In Hermeticism, they're known as the Seven Governors. And in Christianity, they're known as the celestial hierarchies. And they overlap. And what they essentially say is that when the soul dies and it has transcending to heaven, it passes through these Kabbalistic spheres. This would be the Sephirot. In Hermeticism, it's the Seven Governors. In Christianity, they're known as the celestial hierarchies. This comes from the works of a character called Pseudo-Dionysius, the celestial hierarchies. This was accepted by Thomas Aquinas. And what these celestial hierarchies are levels of spiritual purification, that the smarter the person was on earth, the easier it will be for this spirit to pass through these celestial hierarchies and return to the Godhead. The problem is, and this is in Kabbalah and in Hermeticism and even in Christianity, is again, these hierarchies are guarded by these archons, and you have to navigate your way through past these archons in order to return to the Godhead.
All right. So if we look at a movie like The Matrix,
this would be your Valentinius thread.
All right. So everyone, unbeknownst to them, is actually, you know, asleep.
Correct.
And they're hooked up to this machine, and they're being basically utilized for their energy, right? Their life force.
Absolutely correct. This would be the Matrix, Dark City would be your prime examples of the Valentinian Gnostic thread. The Truman Show, you could throw this in also, where you have the architect. We'll stick with the Matrix. So you would have the architect, the creator of the false reality. He turns up in part two. This would be your demiurge. This would be your demiurgic artificer, the fashioner of the false reality, the material realm. You would have the people who are trying to obtain consciousness. This would be your Valentini, the person who would be in Valentinius's cosmology, the Jesus Christ figure is the person sent down from the monad trying to awaken everybody. And of course, this is he's heralded by this pagan god known as Hermes Trismegistus. So in the Matrix movie, you'd have Morpheus would be the Hermes Trismegistus analog. He's the one prophesizing the one. And of course, this would be Neo. This would be the Gnostic Christ, who's coming down to awaken everybody to this false reality.
So Morpheus is like John the Baptist in the Christian. He's the forerunner.
Yeah, exactly. He is in comparative religion. John the Baptist is Hermes. So the Morpheus character is the Hermes Trismegistus, wisdom bringer, enlightener, prophesizer of Jesus Christ. If you read the Hermetica, these dialogues by Hermes Trismegistus, allegedly written by him, he prophesizes the coming of the Son of God. So the Morpheus character would be the prophesizer, the herald of the coming of the one. Neo would be the Gnostic Christ, who's coming down to awaken everybody to the false reality. You have the Demiurge would be the architect. You have the Archons would, of course, be the agents. This is the guardians of the false reality who are trying to keep everybody asleep, keep everybody in stasis. And then you would have, the character of Trinity would be the Sophia, the divine feminine character, who is, you know, the Sajiji with Jung, the unification with the masculine to obtain this higher Godhead to help awaken everybody up. And you'll see this in the movie. I mean, the Neo, when he's introduced, is referred to as Jesus Christ. You have the whole idea, the Lewis Carroll reference to Alice in Wonderland. Again, the Alice in Wonderland story is a story of Gnostic epiphany where Alice goes underground to have her great awakening. And again, this would be reflected in Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy goes on this, you know, journey to the magical realm to have her great awakening, which for her is there's no place like home. For little Alice, it's the world of adults is no good. It's just basically make-believe.
Does this mean necessarily that all of these directors or screenwriters in each of these cases were Gnostics? They were adherents to Gnosticism?
Absolutely. I think you could definitely say that. I mean, you clearly have, you know, the strong Gnostic thread in the Matrix. I do not believe it is mistaken or unintentional. I believe it is intentional. And like, you know, what makes this even more curious is from the years right at the turn of the millennium. And you could probably craft an argument that maybe syncs with the age of Pisces going to Aquarius. You had this slate of Gnostic movies released. I mean, it's all right in that time frame from about 97 to 01, where you had this, you know, Hollywood just pushing out one Gnostic movie after another, whether it be The Matrix. You know, it's all the ones we know and love. I mean, it's The Matrix, The Truman Show, Dark City, Existenz, Donnie Darko, Vanilla Sky, 13th Floor, you know, Minority Report to an extent. You had Hollywood just pushing this incredible slate of Gnostic films all in this narrow time frame. Hmm.
Robert, I got to take a time out. We'll pick this up on the other side. Yeah, Robert W. Sullivan III, Cinema Symbolism 3. And we'll get to more of this conversation in about 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Keeping an eye on the New World Order. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett.
Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Unveiled, with writer, mystic, philosopher, antiquarian, Robert W. Sullivan III, or the fourth, sorry, Robert W. Sullivan IV. Alchemical symbolism. What is alchemical symbolism?
Right. So an alchemical movie is generally one where it doesn't involve turning lead into gold, although you do have the movie Goldfinger, which is just that. That's probably one of the godfathers of the alchemical films, where he's not turning gold into lead into gold, but he's messing around with gold, trying to make it his stock more valuable. And the
right, he wants to make it radioactive, right? He wants to make gold radioactive so that his gold will skyrocket in value.
Correct. So in that form, he is an alchemist. I mean, he's got his little philosopher's stone there with the radiation device, the dirty nuclear weapon. But generally, what I define an alchemical movie is, it usually involves the protagonist transitioning from one thing to another, from one sense of self into something completely different. This usually, you know, there's something at the beginning of the movie, and by the end of the movie, there's something completely different. And it's usually a profound change, and it's usually very negative. Sometimes it's positive. It's a little different than the Gnostic Epiphany movie, where, like, at the end of The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy's still the same character, but she's just wiser. So that's really more of a Gnostic film. The alchemical movie is something like Black Swan or The Shining, where the Jack Torrance character starts out as kind of this failed writer, or maybe struggling writer is the better descriptor. And by the end of the movie, he's a full-blown psychopath. Same thing with Black Swan, where she's sort of this frustrated ballerina at the beginning of it. And by the end of it, she is this sort of psychotic bird creature, as it were. So those are, in my estimation, alchemical movies. They all generally – I'm sorry, did you jump in there?
No.
But they generally follow – if you have the eye to see this – they follow a certain color scheme that the good alchemical films always seem to follow, and that is in Renaissance alchemy, there was these four phases of alchemy that that are reflected, and they're also psychological. Carl Jung equated them to psychology, and it's very potent. And these filmmakers are very aware of it, because a lot of the archetypes revolve around this. Not all of them. The villain usually always revolves around this. And if you become familiar with these color schemes, these Renaissance alchemical color schemes, the alchemical movies really stand out. Because 99% of the time, these colors are always represented in some form or fashion.
Give me an example of that.
Oh, these color schemes. Sure. Twin Peaks is one of the best examples of this of them all. The colors are black, white, red, and yellow. And those are not the order they go in. The first phase is the black, followed by the white, then the yellow, and some leave out the yellow. That's sometimes left out. And then the red is the finality of it. Twin Peaks is a great example of this, where the TV show, the original TV show in 1991 was very alchemical, where it was the whole idea was the Black Lodge and the White Lodge. Those are two of your colors. You have to integrate your soul to become whole. And this is what's, you know, it's the negredo, which is the black, the albedo, which is the white, and the finality is the rubedo. That's the red. And if you pay attention to this, it's right off the bat, the Audrey Horne character played by Cheryl Finn, wears the black and white shoes, and she takes them off and puts on the red high heels. And this is the whole function. This is foretelling the whole thing. Is the whole purpose of the Black and White Lodge is for the soul to undergo this alchemical transition, the positive with the negative in the black. This is explained by the Hawk character, the Indian police chief. Or sheriff, as it were. This is the whole function of the white and black lodges, is to integrate the soul, the positive with the negative, white and black lodges, the albedo with the negredo, to produce the finality of the rubedo, the red. And this is one of the reasons why red saturates Twin Peaks.
Interesting. But again, that would wash right over me. I would not know the significance of those colors. But you're saying that these are somehow subtly affecting my subconscious.
Correct. This is Gnostic thought. A lot of the Renaissance alchemists took their cues from the Gnostics. And again, when you're dealing with this is psychology. This is what Jung said is straight psychology. You know, in cinema, the negredo phase. This all is ultimately the villain. This is what he would call the shadow self. This is Darth Vader. This is an archetype. The albedo, the one phase is the moon, the whitening. This is the feminine. The yellow is the sun. This is the masculine. The rubedo is the finality. This is the unification of the sun and moon. These are our archetypes. Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, James Bond, the Bond girl. These are all archetypes lurking in your subconscious mind that you're not even aware of. And these filmmakers are tweaking them, twisting them, tinkering with them to make you watch their show. Oh, this is really interesting. Why is she putting on red, taking off her
right.
black
Okay,
and white
Robert,
shoes?
I got to jump in. This was a short segment. We'll come back and discuss further. Robert W. Sullivan IV. And the book is Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Unveiled. And we'll do some more unveiling right after this.
You want the truth? You can handle the truth. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett.
So, Robert, one of your, I guess, I don't know if he's your one of your favorite directors, but you certainly are very interested in what's happening in the movie Midsommar. Ari Aster, talk to me about the symbology in Midsommar. First, maybe explain a little bit about what this horror film is all about.
Sure. I'm very impressed with both his movies, Hereditary and Midsommar. Hereditary came out first. I saw Midsommar first, and I was so impressed with it, I went back and watched Hereditary. I'd never seen Hereditary, so I watched them backwards. But this is one of those movies where, you know, you watch it and it just really stands out. I mean, it's striking. This is a director who clearly knows what he is doing. He clearly knows what he is going for. And the reason why I like that movie so much is it reminds me of The Wizard of Oz, partially because it is The Wizard of Oz, but it's multi-layered. Anytime a movie is multi-layered, that always impresses me. And what I mean by multi-layered is it has different levels of undercurrent. Like The Wizard of Oz, for example, I'm not going to stay on this point, but like it has the political allegory and then has the Gnostic allegory. Midsommar is the same thing. I mean, you have... So much going on. I mean, you have it borrowing from other movies. I mean, if you ever seen The Wicker Man with Christopher Lee, it strikes you immediately that this was part of what he was drawing from. He invests the movie with the number 9 all over the place, and I can't get into it all, but it has to do with Norse mythology. The movie takes place in Sweden. And so there's lots of Norse mythology, and the number 9 is critical in Norse mythology. What makes that so interesting is the movie is very dark. It's very evil. I said, I may have been on your show, I can't remember. I said, it's one of those movies that reminds me of like The Exorcist and The Black Cat with Lugosi and Karloff, where it's like you almost feel like the devil is in the celluloid. And that's kind of what I felt when I was watching Midsommar. It's very evil. I mean, it's a very dark, dark movie. Just like those other two. And you have this whole idea of it being a retelling of The Wizard of Oz, where you have this young woman going on this mystical journey, very dark, with these three companions who are all representative of the three companions of from The Wizard of Oz. I mean, you have the boyfriend, Christian, who is the Cowardly Lion. You have Josh, who is the scholar, but he's heartless. He doesn't have a heart, so he'd be the Tin Man. And then, of course, you have the Fool, who lives only for pleasure, which would be Mark. And she has this very dark epiphany at the very end, where she's integrated into this death cult, essentially. And what makes it so interesting is just the solar symbolism. I mean, you have a lot of references. There's a reference in it to a couple of the Kubrick movies, The Shining. If you watch the movie, pay attention to when Danny, this is Florence Pugh, this is the protagonist, when she's sleeping in the bunkhouse, the bed, the blanket that she's using is reminiscent, has the same pattern as the carpet from the Overlook Hotel. I thought that was very clever. And again, that's to convey a sense of isolation, that they're in the middle of nowhere. And what makes the movie so very, very complex is, and again, this is reviewed on multiple viewings. I think in my book it takes up like 75 pages, I believe, just Midsommar alone, is the runes. Is you have the use of the elder and younger Futhark runes in the movie, and they have meaning. Believe you me, you cannot do an analysis of Midsommar without mentioning the runes, because they turn up, and when they turn up, they are intentional. And again, one of the things I thought that was very interesting, I skipped over this, was this use of the number 9. If you go back and watch Hereditary, which was his first movie, this is a movie about demonic possession, and it focuses on a specific demon named Paimon. And if you've seen Hereditary, of course, you know exactly what I'm talking about. What makes this so interesting is, and I wonder if Astor did this on purpose, is if you pull out your copy of Ars Goetia from the bookshelf, The Lesser Key of Solomon, and you open to
Paimon. I've got that right handy right here, Robert.
Yeah.
Your reading list is incredible. I mean, unimaginable.
If you open the book to Paimon, you'll notice he is the 9th demon in Ars Goetia. And again, the number 9 pervades Midsommar. And if you watch Hereditary, you'll know that that movie focuses on Paimon. So I couldn't help but think, oh, maybe he's trying to conjure this demon again by investing, by putting Paimon subconsciously into Midsommar. But it's a very dark movie.
Wait a second. You think that Ari Aster is actually, because you mentioned, with that film, as with a couple of other examples, that the devil is in the celluloid. Do you think Ari Aster is a Satanist? Is he trying to summon a demon?
I don't think he's a Satanist. I think he's just making his – I think he's making very dark films. And I don't think he has a – and I think he likes the world. I mean, I don't think – I mean, I wouldn't go so far. I don't think Ari Aster is a Satanist no more than William Friedkin or William Peter Blatty were with The Exorcist. I think he's a very dark filmmaker, and he's using demonism in his films. But I wouldn't go so far as to call him a Satanist.
Do you think he believes in the power of these symbols?
I think he believes in the power of darkness, because he has two very profound movies about them. And both movies are incredibly dark. I call him in the book, I define him. I think he's this generation's, based on what I've seen so far, version of Roman Polanski, you know, just this very incredibly dark filmmaker. And what I mean that one, what I mean by that is I'm talking about Polanski, the filmmaker, not his extracurriculars.
Right, right.
I mean, you have, I mean, you know, you just look at Polanski, whether it be Rosemary's Baby, I mean, or, you know, The Ninth Gate, or certainly Repulsion. I mean, we're just dealing with some very, very dark themes and very dark cinema. And Aster is walking that same path.
Yeah, I find it difficult to watch those movies. I can understand the artistry involved and so forth and the storytelling, but I can't allow that to seep into my house. I don't understand the purpose of a film like that. It's so dark and so bleak. And I always feel, I feel the same way about sort of these zombie apocalypse movies. I feel at the end, just complete hopelessness.
Yeah, I know people to this day who can't sit through The Exorcist. I mean, so, you know, what you're saying is, resonates with me. I don't have a problem with them per se. Horror is, I guess I'm probably a bit of a horror buff. That's probably one of my favorite genres. But no, they are very bleak. Those movies, you know, they do have that dystopian ending, which a lot of people are very uncomfortable with. You know, you get into sort of, I was on another show talking about this, where you get into, kind of what I've called like the satanic trio of these, of movies, you know, I define it as The Exorcist, The Omen, and Rosemary's Baby. They all came out in that 8-year time frame from about 68 to 76. And those three movies are impenetrable. You just have those as sort of the satanic trio, as it were. And excuse me, the reason why I believe that is the case is they have that dystopian ending that you're talking about. They're so bleak and so dark, where evil wins. Evil triumphs over good. You take a movie, for example, that came out in 68 also called The Devil Rides Out, which was based on a novel by Dennis Wheatley. This came out the same year as Rosemary's Baby. And it stars Christopher Lee. He plays the good guy in that one. But that movie is never, ever it involves a cult of Satanists. The Makata character played by Charles Gray is a Crowley analog. But that movie is never, ever, ever mentioned in the same way as those other three. Yet it came out in 68. And it has the scene in it where the Crowley character, Makata, conjures Baphomet to go to Mendes. Yet that movie is never, ever put into the same category as those other three. And the reason is, if you watch The Devil Rides Out, good triumphs over evil at the end. Good clearly emerges victorious. Mokada and his cult, the devil worshippers, are thoroughly defeated. This clearly isn't the case in Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, and The Exorcist, where evil is exalted and evil triumphs over good. So yeah, I mean, they're very dystopian. Even in a movie, another movie that kind of reminds me of that is the one with Vincent Price. It's not satanic or anything. It's The Witchfinder General. That was released in the United States as The Conqueror Worm. I don't know why. But that movie has that dystopian ending where you watch it and you're like, oh, God, is that really the ending of it? You know, where it's like insanity. It's a good movie, probably one of Price's best performances. I absolutely love the movie, but again, has that very dystopian ending, which is very disturbing. And it can be. It's people walk out of the theater and it's like, God, did I just, you know, really spend,
right,
you know,
right,
2 hours of my life watching something so bleak?
I want to leave a film or a theater feeling uplifted. Yeah, however. Sure. to each his own. Robert, stay with us. We'll head on into hour two, and we will talk about things like occult casting. Sure. And sort of mnemonic devices that are used with occult symbology. And also, of course, we will get around to predictive programming. Sure. Robert W. Sullivan IV, the book is Cinema Symbolism 3, The Mysteries of Occult Hollywood Veil. Back with more in a minute. Don't go away.